This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
When you look so good, the pain in your face doesn't show.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your band of unruly and totally not representative acolytes of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. When the world is ours, the world is not your kind of thing. No, that is... That's You're the Best Thing About Me, U2. They have a new record. It's called Songs of Experience. That is a song of experience, sort of. Anyway.
Plenty of experience, excuse me.
And you know, if we're talking about U2, you know John Varelas, chief pop music critic in the New York Times, is in the building. Hey, John.
Hey.
Okay, so JP, you double dipped on this U2 project.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. I'm all in favor. Okay, so let's map out what's happening. Songs of Experience came out. It comes out today. If you're downloading this on the day of release, it's Friday. But they've been working on this project for quite some time. So before we talk about the album, qua album, we're going to take a step back because you went to the studio with U2 more than a year ago.
Well, actually,
this thing has been cooking.
We're going to take a number of steps back.
Okay.
I interviewed them when they were starting their Songs of Innocence tour back in Canada.
Right. Good point.
And
Songs of Experience counterpoint to Songs of Innocence.
Yeah. They kind of had to do the sequel.
Yeah. It's a, okay. Right. It's obligatory.
Backstage on the Songs of Innocence tour, they had a recording studio set up.
Right.
And they played me a couple of these songs then in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Early different versions. One song on this album, they turn the lyrics upside down. I think they work all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this is a band that steadily works. They don't take 3 years off.
I heard some of the songs then backstage at the rehearsal hall. Then in 2016, I went to the Ambassador's Residence on the Dalkey Peninsula, which is kind of like Dublin.
Yeah, it sounded really posh. It was very posh.
It's pretty posh. It's Dublin's Malibu. I mean, it's... Really? I mean, it's Oceanside.
Is that oxymoronic?
No.
Okay, because I have not been to Dublin.
It's a little craggier.
Okay, to be fair, I've not been to Dublin.
But of course, you go to Malibu all the time.
Yes. Well, I mean, I've been to Malibu a bunch. It did make me think in reading your story. Everybody should go read this story for the sort of like lavish detail about the setup, the impromptu and yet not impromptu setup. There's bodies of water right nearby. JP, some other stuff going on.
They had an ambassador's residence, which they've used before.
Okay.
Which has big open hallways and
one hell of an Airbnb.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But they had been checking out Led Zeppelin's recording techniques, so they had a drum kit set up in the stairwell where it sounded approximately like a cannon.
Okay, let's hope that that's the only one of Led Zeppelin's recording techniques that they imported.
We don't know.
Okay, so this is
But they were working on this there.
It's quite some time ago. Also, a thing that I felt when I read your story was that I'm not taking good enough trips for my stories. Because as you know, I went camping.
Yeah, you went camping.
I went camping. And you were like you were in Dublin's Malibu.
Well.
I'm going to have to go. I mean, you know what that means.
Yes.
I have to go to Malibu's Dublin.
There you go.
Watch for that in 2018. I'm going to Malibu's Dublin. Popcast listeners, if you have any suggestions for what the Dublin of Malibu might be. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com.
I think it's an Irish pub just off.
You know it?
The highway. No.
Oh, okay. You never know. You might have been
up
there. So, okay. You're out here taking fly trips with Bono, The Edge, and the other guys. So,
that's how they refer to themselves, too.
So tell me, how long were you there? What did you see?
I was only there for an evening, afternoon, evening.
Damn. What kind of hospitality is that?
Yeah. Well,
Bono, if you're listening. Come on, man. You met my man all the way out to the Malibu of Dublin and only have him out for an evening? What did you have that was so pressing going on the next evening that JP couldn't come through?
They were doing more sessions.
Yeah, that's what so, JP, you need to be... Okay, Bono.
But here's the thing.
Next
I mean,
time.
They were working. They were working. Bono rushes in with lyrics he's just written,
mm-hmm.
which completely turn another song, The Landlady, inside out, which they're all excited about.
How does he write? Does he write pen and paper or he writes on his phone?
Computer.
Like
laptop.
On a laptop. Okay. And he brings it in the booth?
No booth. Oh, there you go. There's a YouTube tip. He's sitting at the console open with the music blasting around him like he's on stage.
Uh-huh.
So he really has to project. And he's using a stage mic.
And you can get a clean vocal off that?
Clean with enough,
music,
I guess.
With music back?
Yeah. Huh? That mic must be really directional.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's because if you're on stage, it's got to reject all
right.
that music.
No, that's a good
too.
Point. Yeah, yeah.
But I actually heard him once at a recording session record with a better mic, with like a studio, pristine, detailed mic, and they dump those takes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to take deep breaths and project and really belt the song. It's different from sitting in a, as we have here, a glassed-in, acoustically precise booth.
Are you referring to this booth?
Yes, of course.
I don't want to
state-of-the-art microphones.
I don't want to spoil it for our dedicated listeners, who I'm sure believe that we are operating in like a military grade room of silence. I just maybe I'll put a picture up on my Instagram story. I don't know. I don't want anyone to think I'm not grateful. I'm extremely grateful for the room we have. I would not confuse it for
a professional recording studio.
Not confuse it for that. But I hope you guys, considering last week's episode about Lil Peep was recorded on my iPhone, this is a step up.
This is a step up, clearly.
This is a step up. Okay. So everybody who like got a lot of wax in their ears last week listening to hopefully you're fine this week.
Anyway, he makes himself belt.
Mm-hmm. Is it like that creamy Bono? You know what I mean? Like, is it that real creamy Bono voice? Or does he have to work his way up to that?
There's warm-ups.
Yeah.
There's warm-ups. But the thing is, they do umpty gazillion takes of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Often, I think they do too many.
Yeah.
I think this album would have sounded better maybe 2 months earlier and a little raunchier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have the feeling that everything's really considered, and you want a little more edge on the edge. You want a little more noise. You want a little more randomness.
I may be wrong about this.
You're wrong.
Okay, that's fair. I'll go with it anyway, because I think it's a useful starting point. I don't know that there are any new sounds on this record that are not from the U2 playbook somewhere.
It's a big playbook, though.
It is a big playbook, but like it does feel very familiar to me.
They made an album, which this one reminds me of, called All That You Can't Leave Behind.
Oh, yeah.
When after trying to reinvent themselves with dance music and be as crazy and arty as they could, they sort of said, wait a minute, we're U2. We're good at doing this thing, this U2 thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think since then they've realized that they had already perfected a vocabulary that was good for big, emotional, stadium-sized gestures, and they wanted to keep it.
Yes.
They're not like Radiohead trying to reinvent themselves every time they turn on a recorder. They know how they sound.
And I want to come back to that. And later I want to talk more about that, because when I was listening to this record, I found myself thinking about not so much the songs as like the intent and the purpose. And I feel like we can like revisit that in part two of the podcast.
But at the same time, they're always trying to refigure and refine sounds. I mean, the Edge is obsessive. One conversation I had with the Edge was before they were going on tour, he has a rack of like whatever, 20 guitars, you know, a different one for every song to get that sound. And he says, but when I try to use a different guitar for the same sound, it just doesn't sound right.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody in that stadium can hear the difference except the Edge.
Sure.
And so on this album, there are, if you listen in the background, if you're through those high-dollar headphones, there's a lot of strange, pretty noises going on in the background.
I also don't have high-dollar headphones.
There
just
you go.
To go
with your recording setup.
Yeah, so I'm lacking. I'm out here lacking, apparently. Okay, so there are some themes on this record. Let's listen to a song that I think kind of underscores a couple of these themes. Let's listen to American Soul, and we will spare you the Kendrick Lamar part.
It's not a place. This country is to me a salt. You are.
There are some themes on this record, and I say themes with a capital T. And one of the things that you wrote about in your A&L fall preview piece leading up to this was that a bunch of this record had to be either written or rewritten kind of in the wake of the current political moment. So can you explain a little bit about what the record was intended to be or the direction it was heading, and then talk about the kind of and where we ended up?
Well, I think there was a more hopeful direction considering what everybody thought the election was going to turn out as.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this song was probably already pretty much in the works. I suspect that there was some rewrite on the verses because with all of the anti-immigrant fervor being unleashed during the election,
mm-hmm.
this song suddenly makes very clear that it wants America to be a land of immigrants. But Bono has talked about this a lot. America is an idea. America is an idea of welcoming the world. He talked about this before the election, but afterwards, the song really talks about America as welcoming, and it even has the sort of semi-pun refugee Jesus. I mean, he's hammering that home.
Yes, I wouldn't let a rapper get away with that, and I won't let Bono get away with it either. But I take the point.
but it is a song about America being welcoming.
Ideally
welcoming.
Yes.
Well, it started out as America welcoming a bunch of Irish guys who loved rock and roll.
Right.
And I think it probably detoured toward welcoming immigrants, migrants, refugees.
And that's a theme that they pick up again on a later song on the record, right?
Well, there's a song called Red Flag Day, which apparently in the Mediterranean means storm's coming, the lifeguards are waving the red flag, get out of the water. It's also actually a different kind of groove for U2. It's U2 doing the Police. I mean,
yes.
Very sort of obviously.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the songs on this record that I thought did not sound like a U2 song or didn't sound like every other.
Until Bono starts singing.
Well, yeah, you can't get away from yourself.
All you can't leave behind. But this song starts out with the version I heard last year was Better Get Out of the Water. And he turned it around. And he said, you know, get in the water.
Right.
But then they're at this Mediterranean paradise, swimming in the ocean, catching a breaking wave, and suddenly they realize that just across the Mediterranean,
yes.
People are trying to flee the coast of North Africa and drowning.
Right. Let's check out that part of Red Flag Day.
Not even used today. So many lost in sea last night. The one word that the sea can't say is no.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece, and in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS, not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Judson Jones. I'm a reporter and meteorologist at the New York Times. There's a tendency in weather reporting to have these sensational headlines to drive clicks because a lot of places have to rely on clicks for revenue. At the Times, because we're subscriber-funded, we don't always have to use crazy terms like bomb cyclone or monster hurricane when we're covering extreme weather. We're not chasing clicks. We can just tell you the facts of what a storm could actually do, because trust is a crucial part of good journalism. If you want to support this kind of work and subscribe to the New York Times, go to nytimes.com/subscribe. I don't have to say ginormous hail.
These songs do have dualities tucked into them. I mean, I think that's something that U2 thinks about. It's like, we are privileged. We U2 are privileged, and yet there's all this poverty and sorrow
in
the world.
Yeah, I mean, U2 and Bono especially have been very much at the forefront of kind of like woke popdom.
Yeah.
You know, they were thinking about that 30 years ago and persist in addressing it today. So talk to me a little bit about the difference between this album, Songs of Experience, and its sort of companion piece, Songs of Innocence, which those of you may remember was an album that was involuntarily injected into your iTunes account 3 years ago. I very rarely like Google how to do such and such. Like, I don't do that a lot, but I definitely Googled like how to remove this album from my iTunes account. Which is insane, considering how many random things are in my iTunes account. But I felt like an affront, kind of. But anyway, that album compared to this album.
They're totally different. I mean, they're not really companion pieces at all, except they both have William Blake titles. So they were sort of stuck with the sequence. But Songs of Innocence is directly autobiographical from Bono's youth. It's got addresses in it. It's got the license plate number of the van that blew up in a terrorist attack in the middle of Dublin when he was a kid.
Right.
Very specific stuff. This is the helicopter Google Maps perspective. This is the global perspective. This album is general, and We Need Love, and Take Care of the Refugees. And this is like big ideas. One thing, there's a long liner note for those of you who actually purchase physical products.
Hashtag is a long read. They're hashtag long. Long form.
It's a long form. Yeah, I think it's in the digital.
Check for that long form podcast with Bono.
But there's a long liner note by Bono where he says that this is letters to people. This is letters to his family, to his audience, to America. He also says he had a brush with mortality while they were making the album, which interrupted it and prolonged its recording. But he also had a talk with an Irish poet who told him, write as if you're dead. And he thought this was the advice he would take. I'm not sure it's the greatest advice, actually, because if you're writing as if you're dead, you're forging out your last testimonial. You're, you know, thinking about your legacy. You're not like in the thick of daily life.
Or alternately, you say the things that you're otherwise afraid to say. Maybe is that the impetus or the meaning maybe of that?
That may be.
Yeah,
you're beyond obligation and you're beyond. I mean, maybe it is good advice, but for this album,
I'm going to try that on my next album review. I'm worried for whatever.
You may end up dead.
I'm worried about whoever that's going to end up being. But just know, I said it here first. I'm going to write that next album review like I'm dead. Just FYI, I'm coming.
There's a lot of advice. Get out of your own way. Love is greater than anything in its way. It's kind of a little too goody-goody for me.
Yeah, I actually quite liked the song we opened with melodically and structurally, but I found the words a challenge.
Really? You're the best thing about me? I mean, I think that's a nice thing to say to your loved one.
I don't disagree. There are moments on this album that are just like extremely literal. I don't know. I found it hard to, especially the way Bono delivers these words. And I mean, you know, we can talk for a minute about Bono's voice, which has been written about quite a bit by many, many people, but you can see he sings in a way where you can see his body position, even though you don't see him. You see the kind of like reaching to the sky and the kind of like the room filling. You can feel all of that in his vocal tone and in the way that his vocals are produced.
But you have to remember, I mean, these guys have been playing arenas since, you know, you were in diapers.
Yes.
And
dead ass.
So, and even actually, you know, I saw them in Radio City Music Hall. Even before they were in arenas, they were playing like they were in arenas. They always wanted.
Yes, I've seen some video of early shows, and they definitely were like already on that wave.
Yeah. The giant gesture he actually talks about in these liner notes as being operatic. Operas are way too small. but they want that. They want 20,000 people singing along. They want 20,000 people sort of swaying and shouting.
So in essence, you're saying his vocal approach is intended to trigger that mass level response.
Yeah.
That's the design.
I mean, he has.
Because I don't really think about pop stars doing that. You think about sing along catchiness, you know, you think about like infectiousness, but you don't necessarily think of like a vocal tone that invites people into the party. And that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, Springsteen, too.
I mean,
the stand up and sway. I mean, Bono can whisper.
Mm-hmm.
One gorgeous song is not pitched to the far end of the arena. So it's a choice. But when he's singing about more love in the world, he's really belting it for a reason.
Yeah. No, inclusion is encoded into the words and also into the presentation.
Exactly.
Interesting.
This album to me is really a lot like All You Can't Leave Behind, because it's got some just like boffo songs, and then it's got some, okay, you two, and the proportions are not as high as I would like them to be of the boffo songs. One of the songs I do like quite a bit is The Blackout, which the liner notes suggest that it started out talking about a rock star. It's about dinosaurs not seeing the meteor coming, you two thinking of themselves as dinosaurs. Mm. It's not like they're not self-aware. You know, it's not like they don't know that they are about the last arena band standing, and certainly the last arena band standing that's trying to put out new music,
right,
on a consistent basis.
Let's listen to this and then let's pick that up, because that's what I want to talk about. I listened to this record a few times, which is already, as you know, JP, a few times more than I've listened to most recent U2 records. It probably will not come as a surprise to podcast listeners that I'm not the hugest U2 fan. Although, I went to the, the Zoo TV tour that era.
You were lucky.
Yeah, I mean, I got the T-shirt, I was, from 80, 85, 84 up until that, I was in.
The Great Transformation.
Yeah, I was in. I saw a band that was like passionate, hardworking, interested in evolution, a little weird, but like not too weird.
They had hanging cars.
Yeah, I remember. And then at a certain point I tapped out because I felt like I'd heard every U2 song, and every new U2 song reminded me of all U2 songs. And I can't say that this record feels totally different to me, but listening to it closely got me thinking a lot about what it means for a band at this phase of its career, when it could do the equivalent of like what Billy Joel is doing right now, where Billy Joel plays the Garden every month or two. They could do that, but in stadiums, and they could do that in stadiums around the world, probably for the next 10 to 15 years, if they wanted to, without putting out a drop of new music. When I listen to this record, I hear a mood, a lyrical mood, that maybe is particular to the current moment, but I don't hear a lot of music that feels different or new. And I wonder about the thought process behind making this record. Like, if you had told me this exact record came out in like 2009, I would have believed you. So it made me think, well, why? What's the why here?
Well, I think the why is they still want to say something in that gargantuan style that they have developed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and they really do own that style.
Well,
though others have tried.
too many others have tried.
We'll get to that.
But I think they really don't want to be an oldies act. I know for a fact that it bothers Bono that they haven't had a big hit single since the '90s. That mm-hmm. they haven't had a radio single. I mean, they want pop for its community building.
Maybe they should get Future on a record.
But do you really want them to be trendy? I mean, do you really want them to
I don't want that. I'm just saying maybe Bono wants that.
U2 does trap. I mean,
Irish trap.
Beaudron trap.
Yeah, Beaudron. There probably is that. There's probably someone already doing that.
Yeah, yeah. There's like I got six of them in my inbox.
Yeah, podcast listeners, please email me all the Irish trap that you guys are obviously listening to. I'd like to hear it.
I don't think they want to particularly follow trends. I don't think they want to tagging along.
I don't think they'd be very good at it. You know, you made the point earlier
But if you go back to the Zoo TV era, the Achtung Baby era, they were like plugging into
100%. But they were also closer to the forefront. They were the ones. You know, they weren't the biggest experimenters, but they were out in front. And like, I would venture to say, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, somewhere around like 93, 94. They could have gone in a much weirder direction, but then they kind of re-entrenched and basically like became U2 as we currently know them. Like, I don't think they were ever going to become what Radiohead became, but they could have continued to do relatively left-field things, certainly for an act of that scale.
But they want the bigness.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That was a choice. They made that choice.
Yeah.
And so is bigness the number one driving force of this band?
Well, no. Community is, and I think it's different. Because if bigness is what they wanted, they would have gotten, Max Martin, and they would have signed on for the latest formula.
Actually, getting Max Martin on this sounds fire. If anyone's listening, just curious. Just throwing that out there.
Is Max Martin patient enough to work with U2 for like years on end, refining guitar tones? I think those guys work differently.
I know. He's got like nine guys in that studio. Like, I'm sure one of them's got some free time.
Actually, Jack Antonoff would be a good fit.
Ooh.
Because Jack Antonoff knows big.
Ooh. That's true. And
free suggestion. Free A&R suggestion.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say Antonoff, because like some of those gestures that that Jack does feels like a condensed punk shout-along version of a U2 approach.
Right.
Even early U2, you know, like not later U2, maybe like early to mid-80s U2. Seems to be in there already.
They did try to get Ryan Tedder from One Republic.
Yeah, that's which, not the
but,
wave.
But Ryan Tedder is the 2000s radio-friendly version of what U2 was. I mean, yes. he took U2 from the 90s and, you know, put it through auto-tune or whatever they're putting it through. And so, I mean...
It came out like rice milk.
Yeah. They were trying to get the current version of the sound that they made.
JP, I think you might have just landed on the thing.
What? Anthony?
I think you might have just landed on it.
Oh, well, you can call him.
I'm just saying, if 3 years from now we're sitting at the podcast table and we're talking about a Jack Antonoff U2 record, just know where it came from. That's all I'm saying. Came from here.
You heard it here first.
Would that be the first A&R podcast, an actual A&R decision that we know about? We know you're listening. We know. But to that point, something we were chatting about a tiny bit before we started recording is rock is in a really, and I'm rock by rock, I mean like mainstream, capital R, big doofy rock. Not the cool stuff that we like to write about, but like the big doofy stuff is in kind of a weird place right now. There's not a lot of it happening, and much of what's happening is very much U2 Monkey.
Right.
Your man's in Imagine Dragons, definitely U2 Monkey. I'm sure there are other bands, but, you know, they're not very good.
Well, One Republic.
One Republic. One Republic.
Coldplay really, before that.
Sure. Now, Coldplay. Now, it's interesting. Like, doesn't Coldplay practically seem like the Circle Jerks compared to One Republic? Coldplay. Like, I never thought history would be kind to Coldplay, and I know that I know that you certainly didn't either. But certainly, when you see what happened to the Coldplay formula, which was the U2 formula, like the sort of like squeezed and smooth and detangled version of the U2 formula. Whoever did that to Coldplay, which is One Republic and other bands, The Fray and yada, 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 certainly makes Coldplay seem like way more frictive than they than they seemed at the time. Why is this idea still so current? Because you don't have a lot of bands right now that are big or at least popular that are like trying to make Metallica early 90s Metallica records, you know?
Right.
Because U2 was big at the same time Metallica was big. I think that's actually an interesting comparison point. They were both at their commercial apex at roughly the same time.
Yeah. Well, but U2 was there before.
Right. Metallica was coming from a different place. But in terms of like two different templates of like stadium rock, they were both operating, you know, post-Guns, you know, 88 to 94 maybe. And yet... the bands of today that are trying to make it work, they're not listening to the Black Album, you know, like they're making U2 records.
Well, there's more room in a U2 song for words.
Okay, that's a fair point.
And we're in a hip hop era where people are packing the syllables in there.
That's a fair point.
So there's lots of space in a U2 song. Mm-hmm. You can rap over that if you want to.
But don't you, I guess when I listen to a U2 song, I always think like, wow, no person on earth but Bono could do this. Whether I like it or not, I never think of it as like a replicable thing.
But isn't that a good thing?
No, I agree. But I'm saying like if I'm in one of these other bands, these modern bands.
Why would like, you try?
Is there no one in the room who like is like the bass player doesn't like raise his or her hand and be like, hey, guys, like before we do this, like none of y'all are Bono. Like, I'm not that, like, none of, like, we're just not. So maybe let's just do, like, a country punk record. like, no one's saying that. I find it strange. But, like, there is clearly room because you have bands a la Imagine Dragons. And, like, should we play Believer? Let's play Believer. It's a big record. So that song is very big. You listen to whatever radio stations that play this kind of music, that's a big record right now.
But it must be galling to you, too, to have that on a radio station and for the Edge to know he took my amp setting. And,
wow.
But you too, because they're, you know, years older, aren't on the radio, even
now
though
they can
have a snappy song.
But see, now I'm nervous that they're going to listen to this podcast.
And do the Antonov thing and get
on
the
radio? No, that they're going to work with Imagine Dragons instead.
Oh.
Don't do that.
Yeah, please.
Don't do that. I don't get prescriptive very often on the podcast.
Yes, you do.
It hasn't always worked out. But, well, yes, to be fair, I do. But it doesn't always go well. But I will say, if you got to pick one, please, you got to pick Antonov over Imagine Dragons, if you got to pick. Just saying. We're just throwing that out there.
Well, just to get back to the Blackout, I mean,
yes,
that's a song that seemed to be about a rock star, a dinosaur who doesn't know the meteor is coming. But by the end, it's also asking, and I suspect this was rewritten after the election, the meteor, is this an extinction event? And then it starts talking about democracy. It's pointed in a way that songs about love aren't always pointed. And what I want for this album is, I want this album to be less Hillsong and more The Clash.
Oh, damn. Wow.
That's my hot take.
Oh, my. I mean, first of all, I don't know if any of the listeners really get into Hillsong. Have you listened to a lot of Hillsong? I've listened to, like, more than I would care to, like, to talk about.
I've listened to some.
There's really not much there. It's from a musical perspective. There's not much there. You know, from a worship perspective, I can't speculate. That's between their pastor in his Supreme Louis Vuitton hoodie and the flock. That's between. But musically, there's not loads there. Which is, to be fair, it's like a consistent thing of contemporary Christian worship and rock.
Right.
Like that's, you know, it's not the most dynamic stuff.
Well, it's utilitarian.
Yes,
it's
gets the job done. Right. But it's interesting. That's a super interesting perspective to have, because what you were talking about, you too, before you said community. Mm-hmm. And then we were talking about Bono having a vocal tone that's extremely almost laser targeted towards welcoming the most amount of people in.
Right.
That's actually extremely consistent with worship music.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Is U2 a worship band? Is U2 like a mainstream worship band?
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Oh, wait, I love this.
Considering what you said about worship music, I think U2 is better than that.
Oh, I'm not saying that they're, yes, I think they're a musically better one, but from a structural perspective, I wonder if you look at them through the lens of a worship band, if they actually make a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of Jesus in their music through the whole catalog.
Sure. But not even in like the literal religious sense, just in the, like the thing that makes those Hillsong records, I find them like really unpleasant mostly, but the thing that I think makes them effective, or like say Chris Tomlin, do you ever listen to Chris Tomlin?
Can't say that I did.
Okay. So I reviewed a Chris Tomlin concert very early in my time at the New York Times. Chris Tomlin's a worship singer. His songs are structured in a way that's very easy for people to like find the pocket and find their way in. They're not fussy. The arcs of it's everything is very almost color by numbers. How crazy. I wonder if U2 is like the sort of like the advanced placement version of Christian worship music. Damn. I actually would love to hear if there's anyone out there who is into both U2 and worship music. I'd love to hear more about this. Maybe you're an academic who wrote a dissertation about this and I just haven't read it. By all means, send me the link.
Well, also the sentiments in worship music are benevolent sentiments about love and togetherness and
embrace.
Doing good things, embrace. So, I mean, U2 is very much, when they did their Songs of Innocence tour, part of the staging of the tour was, by midway through the set, there was a wall between the two halves of the arena. You couldn't see the people across. And then that wall would open up and suddenly you were a community again.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much built into the staging. It was very self-conscious part of the staging.
Sure.
And so that feeling that we are all one, we are all singing along, is common to a lot of a lot of religious music, not just worship music.
Yeah.
People have been talking about U2 reverberating like cathedrals, you know, since they started. There's very much that big, open, sacred space sound in the music.
Did they grow up religious?
Yeah.
I'm liking this. I want to read this. Okay. So if there's like
you want to read the worship music dissertation.
I want to read that dissertation. If there's a self-published book by an Irish scholar, I'd like to read it. So if anybody's up on that, please let us know. JP, before we go out, is there a particularly worshipful song on the new record that you would like to take it home and take it to the skies with?
The opening song, Love Is All We Have Left, it's a celestial hymn. It's pretty reverent.
Nothing to stop this being the best day ever. Nothing to keep us from where we should be.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.